Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coral Lee. Joining me today is Rupa Bhattacharya, the newly appointed editor-in-chief of Munchies, Vice's food website and digital food channel. We'll be talking about her role, how Munchies has changed, the power and responsibility of food media, and why non-foodies should care too. Welcome, Rupa.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start the show by doing something new. I've never had an intro question really, but what I'm going to start doing is asking you, where are you from? I feel like that's a very incendiary question, and I want to kind of change how we think about it. So yeah, where are you from, and how has it brought you to where you are today?
So I have a six-year-old, and I literally just explained to him why it's messed up to ask people where they're from. I'm from New York, which is my answer. I was actually literally just having this conversation this morning with a six-year-old about where I'm from. I'm from New York. If you ask me again, I'm from Michigan. And if you ask me a third time, it's, are you asking me why I'm not white? Because I understand that you are not asking me that question with any hostility, basically, I'm from here. I am from, this is a really hard question. Basically, I'm a New Yorker. I've been a New Yorker since I was six, which does not count me as a real New Yorker, but I still stand by it. And I guess my life and my goals have always been to make the world more understandable, make everybody, help people understand each other and better through the medium of food.
Mm-hmm. So when you were explaining it to your six-year-old, how did you tell him why it's not okay? Why is it not okay?
Well, I said the thing that I love the most about New York is that anybody who looks like anything can be from New York, right? We live in a segregated neighborhood, which is weird. And so we talk about it quite a bit. And I was like, oh, you have to be extra nice to people of color here because, we live in a segregated neighborhood. And he was like, oh, that person might not have been from New York. I'm almost like, you're right. They might not have been. My favorite thing about New York is that everybody can be from New York. Mm-hmm. I'm from New York. You're from New York. It is something that I, feel strongly about because obviously I'm 36 years old and have spent a lot of my life being asked where I'm from. The answer is here.
Mm-hmm. And so to go further, where are you from and where are you going?
Gosh, that's a much harder question. I have no idea. Absolutely no idea. Where am I going? I have no idea where I'm going. I am trying to... I just got this new job. I just became editor-in-chief at Munchies, which has been amazing. It's been about 6 months, and it's been phenomenal. But where am I going with it is that I am trying to bring voice to the voiceless or the undervoiced. I'm trying to bring voice to the undervalued. And I'm hoping that, and I'm watching it happen in real time. I'm watching people be influenced and convinced by the value of what we're doing. So that's been really cool. What I'm really hoping is that this brings people to an understanding that there's value in the voiceless and there's value in the undervalued.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's talk about your role. What's a day in the life as someone who's basically a key decider in what we consume in food media?
A day in the life, man, it's hard. There's so much to do and there's so many things to do and there are so many stories to tell. So we have teams in 11 countries right now, which has been super cool. I get to work with people all over the world and figure out what they're excited about. I was just texting with our Danish editor because Denmark's playing right now. And he apparently ran into Rene Redzepi at the game, watching the game at a bar, because of course he did. shocking. But we spend the day trying to figure out, whose stories are being told, what's happening in the world, and how do we tell those stories? Who are the voices? Who do we want to put our support behind? When you have the power of a media organization behind you, you realize that your role is so curatorial, right? Every decision you make plays out in who gets attention, who gets shine, who gets a book deal, who gets funding. Who can point to an article that says, oh, this person's getting attention, they must be legit. And when you realize what power that you have, to both make and break people's careers. I mean, we don't do negative articles. I'm not sitting here trying to like ruin somebody's life for like whatever it is that they're doing. But, you know, the absence of media is also a form of media, right? And so, you know, when you choose what you write about, and everything is zero sum, right? If you write about one thing, you're not writing about another. So everything you do is essentially curatorial. And what does that mean? And how does that reflect the world that you want to see? So basically, I spent a lot of time thinking about the world that I want to see and figuring out how to make that real.
Mm-hmm. And so you said you have editors in 11 countries,
yes.
Right? And so how much of Munchies is, because it feels like a lot of the content is American focused. So how do you decide which, even not only what chefs get focused, but which countries get focused? Or, yeah.
So we have editorial teams all over the world. And so I will communicate with all of them. If I'm just commissioning a story in the South Pacific, I'll speak to our Australian head of content, our Indonesian head of content. I'll speak to a bunch of people, make sure that A, they're not planning on covering it. B, the perspective is relevant. C, like that, essentially that it makes sense for us to do. If they want to have the first crack at it, they're also welcome to. So I get a lot of pitches because I'm Indian and my name has been floating around in a lot of both Indian writer groups as well as groups for people of color in the industry. I get a lot of pitches from India, and we just launched in India. Vice just launched in India. So not Munchies, but Vice. But they are running food content. And it's been really interesting working with Sonal, who's our Indian editor, or Indian head of content, rather, to see what, you know, stories she thinks are too local, what's getting overcovered there versus being undercovered here. And there's a tricky angle to it, right? Like, so there are stories, for example, that, like, let's say, you know, Italy wants to cover the story of a famous Neapolitan chef making a healthy pizza, which was a couple months ago this happened, and people hated it. It was like terrible. It's like made of like sunflower seeds and bark or something, and nobody wanted to eat it. And you know, the Neapolitans, what they're like, if you try and mess with their pizza, like, we're in Roberta's right now, and I'm sure like several Italians would have several heart attacks if they saw this sort of pizza being
there's like honey and stuff on
yeah
it.
Exactly, right? And so, like, you know, there was an outrage. It was a super outrage. And I go, like, wake up in the morning and they're 6 hours ahead, so I like look and I see this article is like booming. And so I asked, we have a translation team who I work with, and they're awesome. We have a global team, and they're phenomenal, and a team of translators. And so I talked to the person who handles the translations for me, and I was like, should we flip this? Should we, you know, run this article? And, you know, I looked at it, and then I looked at it again. And it's cool because, like, I have worked in food media for a really long time, and I speak a lot of languages, and I've never gotten to use any of them. And so this is super dope for me, right? So I can just be like, oh, let me read this thing. And so I read the article, and the article's very, like, it's great. Right, and I'm glad that it came from you know, our Italian team. But the way that the article was written was that it was very clearly written for an Italian audience, right? Who knows the chef already, who knows about the controversy. So, it, like, if we had covered it in the U.S., it would have had to would have required like two paragraphs of introductory information at least to just contextualize it for the authors. Slash, it would have had to be written under a different, like, with a different approach. Like, it would have been much less, oh, so-and-so's back in his bullshit, versus, like, which is what the Italian tone was, because I think they're used to this guy's shenanigans at this point. Whereas us, it's like, you know, Italian, you know, Neapolitan celebrity chef so-and-so has been on this kick, right? But it's so much establishing context to figure out. And again, our audience is young. Our audience is young, and our audience isn't rich. And so, like, they're not going to Michelin star restaurants. They're not going to, like, you know, they're not going all over the world being like, oh, let me try this restaurant in San Sebastian, right? Like, that's not our audience at all. And so, like, frequently the first time they hear about things is from us. And so what do they need in terms of context in order to make that real? So, like, I don't know if that answered your question, but essentially, like, in order for a story to pop for us or to do well for us, it has to have, like, these undercurrent threads that you can relate to being a young person anywhere in the world. The stories that I translate from our international teams still have that undercurrent of universality, or they're about something so remarkable that, like, they make sense anyway. Even if you're never going to get to Copenhagen and try the, like, shawarma made that Noma's making out of celery root, several layers of celery root spread very thin and spread, like, and sliced very thin and layered with, like, truffle emulsion or something in between each layer, right? Like, it's basically al pastor slash shawarma made out of celery root. Like, that's fascinating. I mean, you know, I roll my eyes as much as anybody else, but that's still fascinating. Mm-hmm. Even if it's not universal, even if you're never going to get to Copenhagen and buy the vegetarian tasting menu at Noma, it's still dope. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of how I decide what international stories get play. Mm-hmm. If we don't have a team in the country, then interestingly, because we have the largest editorial team, if we don't have a team in the country at a given moment, we'll cover it from the States and people can flip if they see fit. So I'll get pitches frequently from, you know, our French editor will send over pitches from French journalists who are based in somewhere else and send those over because they're not relevant to Munchies France, but they would be relevant to Munchies US. And then if he wants, he can flip them. If that answers your question.
Yeah, no, I'm very invested in this pizza story, though. So in this one instance, would you then deem it worthy to give the American audience a context? Or is it just kind of like, this is never going to make sense? It's not going to hit the same way that it did the Italian audience, and so we're just going to let it go?
So in this particular situation, it's interesting. Like, it would have made more sense. We did flip the story. But it would have made more sense to have it written from the U.S. point of view and run it by Roberta, our Italian editor, for approval.
Okay.
Generally, like, so more frequently than not, flipping is fine. But with a situation like this, where he's so well known in Italy and so not known in the States, like, there's just so, like, the entire tone of the article has to be different.
Okay. Yeah. So, you were talking about how what you do, or what Munchies is trying to do, is basically cultural writing with food as a lens.
Yes.
And so has this always been the way for Munchies, or how has it changed over time?
It's definitely always been the way. The founding editor is a woman named Helen Holliman, who's incredible, and she basically pioneered this idea of using food. Many people use food as a lens for cultural reporting, but she did a really good job convincing both Vice and Young People and people in general that this was a valid and legitimate way to approach food writing, that it's not, you know, 15 delicious dishes for blah, 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 right? It can be meaningful and relevant and a way to open the door into a community that you might not otherwise have understood. So basically when I took over, I'm basically just doing more of the same. I'm trying to make it be, the pillars, the way that I see them of our coverage are culture, identity, utility, and what the fuck. It's official. It's like, it says it in PowerPoint decks and stuff. Like, it says what the fuck. It's like, great. My ability to not swear is really limited. So it's great. It's really handy. So culture essentially being like who we are affects what we eat. Identity is a sort of flip side of that. It's another side of that, which is how what we eat affects who we are. Utility is all of the things that people come to Vice to learn how to be cool in many ways. So it's like, you know, how to cook, how to eat, where to eat, you know, that sort of stuff is all utility. Recipes is a huge part of that as well. And what the fuck is everything else is all the things that, like, we are kind of known for, like the fights in fast food restaurants and the stories about the obscure winner of the guy who won the McDonald's Flexitis competition and, like, you know, long-form meditations on the sex lives of fictional characters that represented fast food restaurants at some point or another. You know, like, things like that is what is the 25% of weird that people come to us for. It's a combination of those things. But one of the things that I really like, and people have told me, is that people come to us because they like to write. They like to write in their own voices, and they like to have their own voices heard without mediating context. So I don't necessarily write with a particular audience in mind. I definitely don't write with the kind of audience in mind that's the same audience as, like, many other food publications. I'm not explaining things to people, necessarily. It's not, this spice is blah, 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 which you might know from your experience, your one experience at an Indian restaurant in blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not doing that. I'm not assuming that the audience doesn't know about X, Y, or Z. Because the audience might be Mexican. The audience might be Indian. My audience can be from anywhere. My audience can be of any origin and any descent and be familiar with, have any kind of cultural capital and experience. But also, I think that young people don't necessarily expect to be explained to in the same way that many older audiences do. They have the same, if they need to know a word, they can look it up on the same internet that they're reading us on, right? And they don't, I think younger audiences tend to not be as sort of in need of handholding necessarily. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's unfair, but, like, in my experience, nobody's writing and being like, I never heard of this ingredient, how dare you write about it? Whereas I used to get emails like that all the time. Mm-hmm. Every time, I used to be the person who, if you emailed the Food Network help desk for, advice, you'd get, I would get that.
Wait, what's the most bizarre question you've gotten?
Oh my gosh, I got great questions. the most bizarre question was a woman, I'm fairly certain it was not a real question. I was fairly certain it was actually like a pudding fetishist, asking me, like, I'd every so often I get emails from this guy who's described himself as Pudding, and he lives in Pudding, Guam. I haven't thought about this in a really long time. But yeah, I used to get these pudding emails. But besides the putting emails, like, you could always tell when a certain episode of Alton Brown aired because he had put Ra's al Hanout in, or rather, no, he had put grains of paradise in, like, his cheesecake. It was something really random. He put grains of paradise in something, and every time that episode aired, I'd come in on Monday to, like, 70 emails being like, what are grains of paradise? And, like, you found the email address.
Right.
Like,
why didn't you look it up?
Right. Like, you, like, the amount of steps it would take to get to that email address. It's like, it wasn't easy to find. Like, right. Definitely. So I definitely don't get that now. Mm-hmm. We're not getting DM'd on Instagram being like, yo, you know, what's a bone marrow? Right? Like, that's not happening. Which is cool. Yeah. You know, it's also really interesting. We know we were talking earlier before we got on air about, how Instagram's role in food / social media's role in food. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fascinating. I mean, I think it's super fascinating. I love the fact that, I mean, it's interesting. It's a double-edged sword, right? Because while food, Instagram and social media have fully democratized what gets to be relevant and what gets to be legitimate in the world of food, it's also sort of devalued the sort of expertise. And so how do you handle that, right? Like, it means that, like, what's amazing is that so many different types of food get to be shown in a world that used to only focus on a couple, right? Like, mm-hmm. And so that's really interesting. There are foods that, like, I don't know, I definitely remember pitching, like, raclette, you know, years ago, and being told that it was too obscure, and now, because Instagram is so obsessed with dripping cheese, like, raclette's everywhere, mm-hmm. right? Like, I've pitched raclette for something, you know, at the Food Network, and it was like, oh, no, nobody wants that. Like, nobody knows what that is. Like, that's weird. And now raclette's on literally everything. It's all, like, every third Instagram picture in my sponsor, in my suggested feed is cheese being... And that might be a reflection of me and my values, to be fair. But, you know, like, there's hella raclette on the internet now. And I think raclette, like, the mainstreaming of something like raclette, which is, again, like, it's not that obscure. It's a cheese that melts, and, like, it's not... It's a fairly easy thing to relate to. Mm-hmm. But the idea that, like, this sort of foreign European thing is all of a sudden, like, mainstream in a very particular definition of what, a very particular and very narrow definition of what mainstream means, is fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's also really interesting because, like, who has access now, right? Who gets into these positions? Who has access to anything? I mean, I got my first job because my old roommate left the paper New York Times on our couch, and there was an ad in the paper New York Times for a wine magazine that was hiring a tastings assistant, and I faxed my resume in, because that's how old I am, I faxed my resume in, and, like, got it, because when I came in, I interviewed, and, like, there was a tasting, and I was, like, they asked me what I thought it was, and, you know, I was, like, close to right, and it was, I mean, I got this job out of, genuinely, because I faxed a resume in from the, you know, paper New York Times, mm-hmm. which, like, who has a paper in New York Times? I mean, who had a paper in New York Times at the time, right? Like, you have to be in a very particular demographic to be getting the paper in New York Times. And now you don't necessarily need to be in a particular demographic to see a job listing. You know, like, you can be anywhere and from anywhere. And again, there's still a tremendous amount of cultural capital required in order to be in whatever position that you want to be in. But it's really fascinating how the internet has flattened the landscape of who gets to be seen and whose food gets to be seen.
Yeah, I would counter that, though, because I feel like it also depends on who you follow, right?
Yes.
Because I would not see anything on raclette. Like, my feed has just a ton of pickles on it. And so it also, while it is democratizing, it also, I am being shaped by what the people I follow are interested in. And so how...
Are you being radicalized into pickles? Is
I
this
think
like
so.
YouTube when you watch like one thing on YouTube
I
and all of a sudden you're watching like conspiracy theories?
Yeah, all my suggested videos are like, ferment this.
Oh, for real?
Yeah.
That's fascinating. See, I have to watch, I keep a good number of those like kind of cheesy videos in my feed because I need to know about what they're doing for like business reasons.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a non-zero, and I also like, you know, full disclosure, definitely when I am stressed out, get stoned and watch cake decorating. So,
wait, what do you want?
Cake decorating. They're so soothing. Oh my gosh. The woman has a turntable and it's just like slowly combing icing. Like they're basically, they're ASMR videos, but I hate ASMR because I don't like the sound of people chewing. but they're like, like soundless ASMR videos of people just decorating cakes really beautifully.
Huh.
And they're on turntables, so you're just watching things be smoothed really carefully. Ooh, and beautiful. Amazing. It's so beautiful. And then there's always a payoff, even though you never eat these cakes. Mm-hmm. You never eat these cakes. These cakes look horrific to eat. They look like they're made primarily out of, like, sponge. They're not good.
Right.
They're probably the vast majority of the cake base is, like, I mean, I'm sure it's box mix because that stuff is stable. But it's so beautiful. But you get the payoff. You get the beautiful payoff. They slice a piece. The piece is always much too large. The cakes are always much too tall. Nobody ever wants to eat that cake. But I will watch the fuck out of those cakes being decorated. So my Instagram feed is a lot of those videos.
Yeah, I'm going to push on that, though. What is the payoff? What do you get when you're watching
those
videos?
Well, so the calculated payoff is the slice of cake, right? That's, I mean, there's a method to these videos, right? Like, you want that visceral moment of joy that you get. And theoretically, then usually that comes. And I made these videos. I made these videos for Food Network Snapchat for years. There's a visceral moment that you're trying to, like, get to. There's, like, a payoff moment. But, like, with the decorating videos, they're just, like, so... I mean, it's the same thing as soap carving, which is such a weird phenomenon that I don't fully understand. And it's also kind of gross to me. Like, I mean, they're compelling. Not that I won't watch them when they're on my feed. But, like, why are you carving the soap bar? Like, at least I understand with a cake. Like, the end goal is cake. And that's a reasonable end goal that I can, you know, morally understand. Whereas soap carving... Have you seen soap carving? You know what I'm talking about?
Would you not use a carved soap?
Wait, have you seen soap carving? So soap carving is really weird. They take a bar of soap and they essentially, like, score it, like, with a crosshatch pattern, essentially.
Oh.
Like, you know, like a quarter inch deep or so. Fairly narrow, thin crosshatch pattern where it's scored. And then they take a knife and cut parallel to it and then just, like, slice off the little bit squares of soap. It's very weird. No, it's basically just wasting soap. Like, there's no reason for it. Like,
you should, wait, that should be a story. Where does the soap go?
What happens to the soap and soap carving? No, for real. Like, where does it go? So I get it with cake more than I get it with soap, for example, but I'm still, I mean, please. I'm also getting soap carving videos because Instagram knows me. Again, I'm being radicalized into being much more chill, which is probably for the best for everybody involved. It's fine. That is really interesting that you are getting primarily fermentation and I am getting, again, because I follow a number of the mainstream food sites for just so I know that what people are doing and to mm-hmm. know what people, like, what's going on and what the competition's up to. That's really interesting. The people I know who are my friends aren't usually posting videos of themselves cooking. Like, I have an Instagram and it's mostly pictures of my kid. Nobody wants to see my food. I mean, I feel like they might. I don't know. I get, like, my engagement is very much more, like, my engagement is much higher when I post pictures of not food. Mm. My one-person experiment is that nobody cares about my food. But there are so many Instagrams that are so many pictures of food, and, mm-hmm. and they're not as good as, you know, they're not very, I don't know. Maybe I should have. I have been debating a second Instagram, like my teenage nieces have Finstas, where they post pictures of themselves making faces and, like, not with makeup on.
Yours will be soap carving.
Mine will actually just be food. Like, I should actually have a food Instagram. Yeah.
Okay, we're gonna take a break. That was amazing. We'll be back after a short break.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska Seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
Hi, I'm Moxie Rosenblum. My dad, Harry Rosenblum, hosts Feast Your Ears on Heritage Radio Network. Right now, HRN is having a summer membership drive. Becoming a member is so easy, and you'll help support shows like my dad's. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer.
Thank you.
It's hard to focus.
And we're back. This is Meant to be Eaten. We were just talking about basically soap carving. So let's talk about how food media has changed. So we were just talking about those like ASMR cake videos and versus recipes. And so how and why would people use recipes, and how and why would people consume these cake videos? Like, what is the difference?
Well, I feel like, you know, a thing that has really changed, it changes hard. It's hard to say. I think that there's definitely much more attention being paid globally or outside of the, sort of the narrow scope of food media to an idea that food media is not necessarily entirely utilitarian, right? So in addition to like food videos, like the top-down style videos, of which I've been told the click-through rate on to the recipes, the actual recipes of these videos, is something like, for most media outlets, around, at tops, about 2%. So people are watching these videos on Instagram, they're watching these videos elsewhere, they are almost never clicking through to the video, to the recipe, rather. And if they are even clicking to the recipe, who knows if they're making it. So I do wonder how much of these videos, so they're essentially consumptive and not, they're passive consumption and not utilitarian, but I also wonder how much cooking is inspired by, right? Like if you see somebody make, you know, XYZ, like this, here's a stuffed shell casserole dish, whatever, you might want to watch somebody pipe those shells over and over and over again. You might make it from the recipe. You might not make it from the recipe. You might think, oh, hey, I haven't made stuffed shells in a while. Stuffed shells are great. Let me make those. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I can't tell how much of that, like, I don't think the click-through rate necessarily, while it's really easy to grab that number and be like, oh, nobody's clicking on this thing. That means nobody's making the recipe. I do wonder how much cooking has been influenced by these videos. And I also wonder, like, there's, you know, there are some dishes that are just genuinely ugly, and those dishes don't get that much love anymore, right? Like, I made it. There's this pie back in the day. Paul Grimes developed it for Gourmet, like, no, 20 years ago. Maybe 20 years ago? It was a while ago. Anyway, it's a cheddar-crusted pie. The dough itself is super short. It's like 60% cheddar cheese by weight. Mm-hmm. So it's super short. It's super crumbly. It's ugly as hell. When it comes out, it looks like it has, like, several skin diseases because the cheese is just, like, bubbling and warting and, you know, it's doing all these things. It's, like, sort of scabby and warty and ugly. It's also delicious. It mm-hmm. is such a good pie. And I made it recently. I made it last year, and I was like, oh, yeah, why haven't I made this in so long? And why haven't I made this in so long? It's because I'm going to spend 3 hours making pie and have it look like that. Mm. I'd be bummed that I don't have a shot for Instagram. I mean, I don't care. Again, I was just, my Instagram is literally just pictures of my child. So like, I wasn't going to put on my Instagram anyway, but like, yeah, it's, you wonder about the dishes like that. Like what happens to the ugly food? Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's really interesting. Like I think, there was a really interesting article recently in Taste about, the millennial dinner party flex and how that's a thing.
Wait, can you, what is that?
The millennial dinner party flex is the fact that fundamentally, like, millennials aren't going to restaurants, but what they are doing is they're making really fancy dinners in their houses and posting pictures of them on Instagram.
Oof, okay.
Right?
Keep
like,
going.
Yes, I mean, like.
Ouch.
Nope, also true, you know, also not untrue. And there are, I mean, obviously tons and tons of factors for why that is. You know, I don't know that apple pie has a place in that dinner party flex. Like, would you flex this ugly apple pie? Like, mm-hmm. I might not. I mean, I probably would because, like, whatever. But, like, but like, I completely understand why you wouldn't, right? I completely understand why you'd want something prettier, why you'd want something that, like, looks more like, you know, that you're... I don't know. I mean, I definitely have friends who don't cook at all who got super into, like, making these elaborate pies with these braided doughs. And, like, the amount of time you would spend keeping that dough cold / manipulating that dough / braiding it into 17 different ways... Like, that's a lot of handling. You're mm-hmm. touching that dough a lot. So what are you doing that it's not tough as hell when you bite into it, right? How are you keeping it cold? Like, the person I'm thinking of is a friend of mine. I mean, she lives in Texas. Like, you live in Texas. You're baking pie. You're baking a pie that you've clearly had to touch the hell out of in order mm-hmm. to make it look like that. It can't possibly taste that good. But, like, is that the point?
Looks cool. Like,
right,
looks
exactly.
Nice.
And so, like, that's really interesting. Like, I don't know... and I don't know what to make of that. I don't know what to, like, I think there's still a huge market for food that tastes good and is delicious, but I think that it still has to bring it aesthetically, and there are some dishes that just are never going to quite, like, you don't see gumbo anymore. Like, I haven't seen gumbo on the internet, really, and again, that might just be because my Instagram feed is radicalizing me to only look at soap carving, but, like, I haven't seen gumbo in a long, you know, I haven't seen anybody make gumbo in a long time.
I feel like there are ways around that. There are a lot of shots that are, like, after you eat the gumbo and it's all gone, or
right,
like
the clean plate or whatever. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So then why do we watch these top-down recipe videos? I don't use Facebook. I hate Facebook.
Yeah.
But when I do go on, there are all these people that like share videos of Oreo cake pops.
Oh,
and
for
just,
real?
Yeah. And so like, what is the point? Who is like, no one's making them, right? And how are we meant to consume these things? And so what's the point of making these videos or sharing these videos? Like, is it more so defining the aesthetic of BuzzFeed, or like what's the purpose?
It's really hard. Like, right, every time Facebook changes their algorithm of what they find to be a valuable social interaction, and they actually have like a name for it. It's like meaningful social interactions, like MSIs. Hmm. It's really like, it's as if you ask robots to describe how humans interact with each other and like quantify it, that's what it looks like. Huh. Right? It's literally like you asked a room full of robots to be like, this is how humans talk. And so essentially like media organizations frequently, if they've made the executive decision to respond to Facebook's asks of them, they are looking for whatever it is that Facebook wants from them. And frequently right now, what that is, I mean, like 6 months ago, it was like Facebook wanted people to be tagging their friends inside the comments of a thing. So like, let's say you make some like Oreo cake pop, right? Or you see an Oreo cake pop and you're like, oh, my friend so-and-so loves that. And you tag them in it, right? So cool. That's an MSI, or it was an MSI 6 months ago. Now, my understanding is that MSIs are like, your friends need to have, or people who know each other need to have conversations in the comments of a story like that, in a piece of content, in order for that content to be like ranked highly on the MSI scale. Mm-hmm. So let's say you post those Oreo cake pops, or somebody posts those Oreo cake pops, and I comment to my friend, hey, you know, you would really like this, and she responds back like, oh no, absolutely not, that's disgusting. That counts as an MSI, even mm-hmm. though it's like, you know. Right, because we know each other and we're engaging in the comments of somebody else's post, that gets that post props, that gets that post later, like heavier weight in the algorithm. Right, so like, so much of this is, it's hard to say that it's coming from food media or it's a statement on food media as a whole. It's how aggressively are the organizations choosing to participate in whatever new algorithm it is that day. Which is, yeah, I mean, so it's not really necessarily an indictment on food media or media consumption at all. It's really, it's how the robots decided that they were going to weight human interaction.
Right. So as someone working in food media, when you are scrolling through your feed and there are so many things that you just scroll past, how do you feel about that? I mean, I feel like when I scroll past something, I unfollow because I just feel like it's trash,
it's
right?
Clutter. Yeah.
So what is the intended audience for stuff like that?
I don't use a lot of Facebook either, honestly. Like, I use a lot of Twitter, but I don't use a lot of Facebook. And I was thinking about my Instagram too, where I follow all of these companies that I don't really care about. Like, I follow, you know, but I want to know we're at Roberta's. If Roberta's having, I don't know if you guys can hear it on the radio outside, but there's a very loud party happening outside. And I found out about it from my Instagram feed that told me that Tiki Disco, which is the party that they both thought that we were lying about, and we tried to get into here to record the video, record the radio show, was happening, right? But like, most of the time, I don't need to follow Roberta's. Like, it's far from my house. I'm never gonna like make it in for like a, you know, Tuesday night special or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I follow Roberta's, and is that clutter? Maybe, kind of. Like, do I need to unfollow Roberta's? Like, I don't know. Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Like, yes, there's a lot of clutter. There's a ton of clutter, and how do you sift through that? I have no idea. I don't have an answer.
And we are people that care about food, you know?
Yes.
And so when people who don't care about food have all this stuff in their feed, why should they care about food media in general?
Well, it's so interesting, right? Because, like, I mean, I'm old. When I got into food media, it wasn't a thing. Like, I mean, people existed. It was, like, a couple guys who had done PhDs at Harvard and were kind of dilettantes writing about food as intellectuals, and they'd write in traditionally male publications, traditionally establishment publications. One was in the Wall Street Journal and the other was in Vogue. And that was pretty much it. So when I went to culinary school, people would ask me where I'd been before that, and I'd say Yale, and frequently people thought I said Yale. Like, really, like, more than many more times than you would expect, right? So I got into this field really early before, like, it was really a field as such, right? Like, it was not a thing. People didn't really do this. In many cases, I was the first person to have the job that I had. And so there's that too. And so watching food change over the years, watching food as a food go from being a thing that people eat for sustenance to being a staple of cultural capital. Like, all the same boring guys that used to corner me at parties to talk about indie rock now corner me at parties to talk about chefs. It's exactly the same. I mean, it's the same demographic. They're just talking about a different thing. And it's super interesting to watch, because in certain parts of the world where we have munchies, food hasn't made that leap yet. Right. And so I grew up partially in Germany. And so, you know, we have a German language team. They used to be running out of Berlin and now they're running out of Zurich. And it's super interesting because it's really hard to make people care about food when it's not part of the cultural conversation necessarily. Right. So like, even in Berlin, all of my coolest friends, they don't get the slightest fuck about restaurants or chefs. They all, even the coolest people I know in Berlin, tastemakers, culture setters, like all of those people, they will eat the same sort of vegetarian casserole and then go get drunk at the art gallery, right? Like, but they're not, I mean, that's, they eat the same, everyone eats the same, like, Gemüse Auflauf, like vegetable right. casserole, and it's just not part of the culture. And so what are the stories that you tell? That what are the stories that work in Germany? And the stories that have worked in Germany is, for example, there's this woman from the former East who makes, like, essentially sandwiches that she goes around and sells to the men of the brothels in Berlin. And like, she's like, her name is literally like cold cut, like Mutti, like cold cut mom, like you know, like, and so like, right, like she's like sandwich mama. And so, and like, you know, she's like a working class woman who goes around at 2 a.m. and sells sandwiches to the prostitutes and the patrons and the drunk people at the bars who are gentrifying that neighborhood, right? Like, stories like that do really well because they're still stories. They're stories about people, right? But if we did a story about like Tim Raue, who's like the, you know, Michelin star chef at this fancy fish restaurant in Berlin, like, nobody cares,
right?
You know, like, and so how do you whose story are you telling, and how do you tell a story? Like, is Schöpfchen Mutti, like, is she a food story? Kind of. Yes, I mean, she is a food story, right? Like, she's totally a food story. She's selling sandwiches at 2 a.m. to, like, prostitutes. Mm-hmm. Like, fully 100% a food story. But, like, you know, what does that food story tell you about Berlin?
Right. So do you think it'll be kind of like a slow process, and that it'll just be a ton of these kind of sandwich mama stories, and finally people will start to realize that there is value to food media? Or is it just kind of like a culturally different thing? People will never get it in the way that we watch cake pop videos.
Maybe. It's really hard to say. I mean, like, I got into food in the first place when I was living in Germany and noticed that, I mean, I was like 16 years old. I got the scholarship from the State Department to finish high school in Germany. And so I was living there and started noticing which of my friends, what snacks they ate, and how deeply tied it was to like class. And it was before the EU. And so, like, you know, currywurst, which you think about as this classic German thing, nobody ate that. I went to a gymnasium, which is like the schools are tiered, and gymnasium is like the top tier of the people who are going to go to college. Nobody eats currywurst. Nobody eats currywurst because like that's not a thing people eat, right? And if you ate like, and if you most people, if they wanted a snack, they would get a döner, which is like sort of the middle to upper middle class snack, right? Like, which is like came from Turkish immigrants, Turkish guest workers, and is now basically as German a food as any other. And then if you, and again, this is pre-EU, so this is probably has changed significantly. This is, you're talking about almost 20 years ago now. But if you liked falafel, because there weren't really Arab immigrants in Turkey, in Germany at the time. So if you liked falafel, then it meant that you'd been to Paris and you'd been to the like places where they had Arab immigrants, and you'd been specifically actually to the falafel stand that like Lenny Kravitz liked, right? Like, there's a falafel stand in Paris that Lenny Kravitz like this has this picture on, and like, if you liked falafel, it meant you were wealthy enough to have gone to Paris to a place with Arab immigrants, right? But it was super tiered. And I noticed that when I was like 16, and I was like, oh, this is really interesting. So I'm from New York. Like, everybody eats the same things here. I mean, kind of, in my experience, like, everybody eats dollar slices, and everybody eats, like, you know, when you're 16 in New York, like, everybody, you know, eats dumplings in Chinatown, and every, you know, like, you're a kid, you eat all the same foods as your friends. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. And I feel like that the way that translates to today is people posting photos of where they went to eat when they travel and
yes.
not necessarily eating it.
Yes.
For like, so yeah, people who do not live in Brooklyn and come to Roberta's and take a picture of the pizza. And,
right.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's actually, if and maybe when I was 16 and lived in New York, maybe my perspective was narrow, but there were some foods that everybody ate. Everybody eats beef patties. Everybody eats garlic knots. Everybody eats dollar slices. Everybody, you know what I mean? Like, and whereas there, it was like some people eat döner and some people eat currywurst and some people eat falafel. Like, and it was much more split out than I expected it to be. And that's what struck me, and that's what sort of got me interested in food in the first place.
So when you saw a friend eating falafel, was that kind of was that intriguing into, like, did you want to learn more about that culture, or was it just kind of, it rested at the, like, economic?
Well, yeah, I mean, for us, it was like, yeah, because people, I mean, I grew up eating falafel at Moon's on McDougal because we would go to the Comedy Cellar, and then, because they would serve us underage, you know, like, and then go get falafel. Like, so, like, the falafel was just a completely normal food to me because, like, you know, like, and so, yeah, I don't know, like, and so when people would be like, oh, falafel, I've never, oh, if you have falafel, I've had it in Paris, like, oh, huh, okay, right, you know, because if you're from New York, you don't realize that New York is different than the rest of the world.
Right.
You have no idea that everyone isn't going to a Moon's after going to the Comedy Cellar, and, like, you know what I mean, like, you know,
yeah.
I mean, everyone will serve you when you're 16 in Germany, it's not like a thing, you know, like, so there isn't a specific place that will serve you underage, because there's no underage, and so, like, yeah, I don't know. So that was one of those things that I noticed when I was young and then, like, didn't really pay attention to, and then, like, started paying more attention to, like, just sort of culture and class and palate and what people liked. And that has always been sort of a thing that I've cared about. And again, it's like how who you are affects what you eat, and how what you eat affects who you are. It's like those are the two things. I'm still doing it.
Mm-hmm. And so to wrap up, what kind of changes do you forecast for food media in style, in focus?
I don't know. I mean, it's been so interesting to see so many people, so many legacy publications, like, really understand that, like, I mean, maybe not really understand, but kind of understand, almost understand, that, like, you can't keep going this way, right? Like, right now, so I'm the only woman of color editor-in-chief in the food world, and I'm the second ever. And so there are not that many assigning editors of color. I think there's four of us, and we're all friends, and we all text, you know, like, you know, so, like, that's really interesting because it's really interesting whose stories are getting told and who's being given the voice to tell the stories. But it's also really, really interesting to watch other publications run stories that are very, very clearly Munchie stories. You know, like, this is a story that you would never have run 6 months ago, but now you're running it, and that's really cool, and I'm really glad to see it. I mean, I'm definitely of the mindset that, like, a rising tide helps all boats. And so, like, I'm super happy if it gets more shine in the people that I care about. That's dope. I'm super here for that. I don't know. I mean, I think that the younger generation is not interested in as much in, like, hearing the same stories be told and watching the same deification of the same people. And I think a lot of people are very disheartened by sort of everything that's happened in the food world and how disappointing so many of their heroes have been. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, in my ideal world, there's more storytelling, more voices, more perspectives. More delicious food.
Hopefully. More soap carving.
More cake videos. Yeah, more cake videos.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, this has been Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.